Sorry, I already did that earlier today. Right. Hence why we have the artistic platings.
Janet.
All right, ladies and gentlemen.
I'll show her later.
Happy Janet. Holidays to everyone. Thanks for taking time out of your busy holiday season and lives to join us for our best of 2024 the whole Liquid Storytelling Project and podcast and wine tasting started this year. And the best thing that I thought to celebrate that we actually made it work was to just celebrate the fact that we drank a whole lot of great things and bring back the panel and the guests from all this year. So tonight, in addition to being stuck with yours truly, we have once again returning to join us Janet Kem, Les Dames Escoffier, culinary extraordinaire in all aspects that I could possibly mention of that. And fortunately, just what, 2 days ago you were traveling? Just got back?
Recently.
So we are fortunate that the stars aligned and she was able to join us. We also have Jean Lampione, who is a culinary chef instructor that I've known for, gosh, going on 10, 12 years now, I guess. Oh my goodness. Has taught abroad in Tuscany, came back here. Born and bred in Kansas City barbecue land, and also, as my wife is fond of recounting, one of the grand members of the 12 Days of Christmas wine dinner, where we actually recreated the 12 Days of Christmas as food and drink. And last but not least, the man that we all need, because without him, you guys couldn't play the take-home game and have these wines for yourselves. The one and only George Fotanakis, our Greek connection. George has suffered going through Austria with me and suffered through many a Wednesday afternoon when I showed up with about 3 or 4 cases of wine to just say, hey, George, you got a minute? So tonight, what I tasked them all with was looking back on the past year, if you could name 1 or 2 things that you really thought were exceptional drinks that you would want to share with everybody. And that was basically the walking papers that everybody had. In your glass, as we just mentioned, was Bandinere, a beautiful sparkling wine. And I know that Jean has had this. I can't remember if you guys have. So if you all have any thoughts on this, I'm going to have a drink because after finally getting the microphones suited up, I need a drink. Jenna is our queen of bubbles. What do you think?
Really easy. It's too easy.
It's bonkers, isn't it?
You keep the refrigerator all the time.
I've always had a love for Blanc de Blanc when it comes to champagnes and everything else. And obviously, you know, we don't always have the Tuesday night $100 bottle of champagne budget. So this is one of those things that I adored because it's a great producer. They actually are in a castle in Emilia-Romagna. If you go to visit them, Monte Arquato is a castle, and they do it right. It's so fun for me to see somebody from Lambrusco territory producing something that's of this high quality level of bubbles. Right, it's definitely not Lambrusco. Gene, what'd you think?
I really like bubbles. I'm a big fan of bubbles. One, because it's really easy to pair with, and bubbles go really great because the sparkling, the effervescence of it is like a palate cleanser. So you can use sparklings to go with heavy foods, light foods, acidic foods, sweet foods, which I really like. So something like this that has some acid and stuff, you can pair with something pretty heavy, and with the bubbles and everything, it's still going to work, which I like. I drink bubbles.
We all like bubbles a lot. As some of you may have noticed, there are a few bubbles selections in our top 6 tonight. Mr. Fotanakis, Georgis.
Love the Blanc de Blanc. It's palate pleasing. It's smooth. It's just, even though you get the little tingle, it's just, I love how it just, and you can pair it with almost anything.
I love how it's just a little toasty and dry at the end. But it's the right kind of dryness, the kind of dryness that makes you be like, oh, my glass is empty. Can somebody help me out with this? But without any further ado, that it goes without saying that we should jump right into it. And as long as we're on bubbles, that leads us to our very first wine. The producer behind this wine, so wine number one, the big reveal, for those of you that didn't notice the bottle as we were coming around, this is the Steiniger Heiligenstein Riesling, their Grand Reserve. You asked. absolutely. It is an amazing family. Basically, every single time Ava or her family come to town, it's just an absolute joy because not only do they do amazing still wines, but they're known as one of the best sparkling wine producers in all of Austria. And it started with the background of Klaus taking Birgitta, his lovely wife, to Champagne, where she fell in love with Champagne and then basically said to Carl, why don't you make these wines? And they have these amazing caves underneath their vineyard and their winery that some of them go back to the 5th century. And they quietly acquired these caves and the land underneath everybody else in their village. They're in the Langenlois in the Kamptal region of Austria. Would you like
Klaus, the importer, suggested that I go to this tasting. And this tasting was 600 wines in 4 days. And because
Yes, she said 600 wines in 4 days.
It's a tasting with professionals. I was in the room with the wine advocates critic, and there were 250 people in the room. And what it is you taste, you evaluate, you assess, and you mark. And I only had two wines that were 100 points, and I was doing 42 wines a day between 9 and 3 o'clock.
Holy smokes.
Then I left to go to my appointments that was a region. My contacted drink. And so the day that I put 100-point wine on the Kleiniger Pilsner, I was so amazed by the vineyard designation that I tasted all 10 from all producers and then made my notes. And then it so happened that I was meeting with them that evening, and I told her the story. Pilsner, they had two hectares, and her sister died rather young. And so the property is worth an enormous amount of money. So she was offered the property first by the daughters, and they bought it. So they have a total of 4 hectares and amazing wine. And I've put them on wine lists for clients. But the Hillenstein was not in the country. Now it is.
I think we have to start with, is there anybody in the group that has a preconceived notion or a dislike of Riesling? Okay. And I'm going to guess, again, it's the common reason where, you know, we've had a lot of that gooey, sweet Riesling, or maybe it's the high school / college / I remember one time when I drank a whole bottle before I went out, and, you know, there's that little headache of sugar and everything else. I mean, am I a little off base on some of the reasons why we're maybe not Riesling fans? I remember Blue Nun and Zeller Schwarzkat, the Black Cat, and everything else. I grew up in the Finger Lakes of New York, and that's where I kind of got my introduction into the world of wine. So it's all about Riesling up there, and I've seen everything from super candy sweet to bone dry, but I've never, ever seen Riesling like this. And all of the sparkling Rieslings that are up in that area, and they're wonderful. This is just magic. I mean, look at the way it shines in the glass, first of all. It is as gold could ever want to be. And the nose is fantastic. Right? Again, it's one of those very special things from a very special place. And the how can you ever say anything bad about Birgitta? She's such an amazing woman and a nice family. Yeah. You got to do a little tasting with Birgitta.
I did.
That with everybody?
In there, on the property, they have the hotel, the Loisium.
Yep.
And she first came out, she introduced herself. She says, put whatever it is that you're drinking away. She says, we're starting, and we'll get to it in a minute. But she comes out with this wonderful 2 or 3 bottles of bubbles, but one of them was a very, very nice start, and we'll have a chance to taste that tonight. But she's the nicest lady in the world. The property was amazing. The caves and how they actually store all the bottles of bubbles in there and how they have to turn them and what they have to do and just the gentleness behind and the patience behind the whole process brings just you an amazing, amazing bottle of sparkling wine, whether it's Riesling or Gruner. Cabernet Sauvignon.
And they just go on and on and on.
She tries everything.
And the process that George was just talking about, I think it's very important to mention, they are still hand-riddling every single bottle that's in their cellar. There's no machine that goes around. Literally, one person's job is to go quarter turn, next bottle, quarter turn, next bottle, quarter turn, next bottle. And it's several million bottles that they are turning and doing that over the course of 2.5 to 4.5 years for certain wines in their production factor. Again, Helgenstein has been the darling of wine critics. I believe this one got 96 to 98 points is the range that you're going to find for most of the big wine critics. It is, to me, something that screams the holidays. It takes me back to, again, when I was first drinking wine. And it also is one of those things that I love that this is a wine that gives you everything that champagne gives you, but once again, does it for a fraction of the cost. Now, it's not inexpensive. You're still going to be looking at, you know, $65, $70 a bottle for this. But again, comparatively, if it was which this is basically Grand Cru. If it was Grand Cru champagne, we'd be talking, you know, Krug levels, $250 and above for this bottle of wine if it was up there. So yeah, we win. And you all win because Janet picked this as her favorite thing to drink. And when she picked it, I couldn't agree more. So this was the very first wine that we knew we were going to be drinking. And from here, it kind of colored everything else that I had because I wanted to pick this wine too. But it's great. I got to pick other stuff because Janet picked it.
Play me. Mm-hmm.
It's delicious.
So good. What do you guys think?
What?
We need more?
That's what it
is. Oh, no. Well, I thought we refilled that. I'm so sorry. But now you just get more.
Taste your
needs. All right. Well, you might want to hang on to that because we're about, or have a quick little sip because we're going to move on. If nobody has any other questions, do you? Anybody? We're going to go on to wine number two then.
Is that something?
So wine number two was a grape that I was first introduced to when we were on a trip over to Italy in 2018. And we were on the overnight flight from Dulles, the 535. Gets in about 10:30 in the morning. We had to wait 2 hours at Flamenco for everybody else to fly in. Gathered everybody up on a bus, and we drove south to Lazio, to the Agro Pontino from Rome. It's about 48 kilometers, a little over an hour. And when we got to the winery that we were going to visit, they let us off the bus. They took us on a brief little tour of the property. And then we immediately sat down and had four wines, just something to refresh you and everything else. And then they took us on a bigger tour of the property. Then we came back from that and we went upstairs to actually have our evaluation of wines, which was about 17. And then we broke for lunch, and we went and had a nice little four-course lunch with six wines. And then they put us on the bus, and they took us to tour a beautiful botanical garden, which took about 2 hours. And then they put us back on the bus, and then we drove to the hotel, which happened to be the wrong hotel. So then we all got back on the bus after pulling off all our luggage, drove to the right hotel, and then we had 20 minutes to get ready before we had to be back on the bus to drive to dinner. And I took that time to go and look at the lovely beer list that was next door at the pub. And everybody else just back on the bus, and we went out to dinner at a Michelin-starred restaurant, which I thought was going to be a brief little four-course meal, but my rusty Italian at that time forgot to notice that it was divided into four courses, and there were 3 to 5 dishes within each of those four courses. And that was the first time that I had the wine that's about to be in your glass right now, wine number two, if you'd like to pour it. This is the Casale di Giglio Anthium. It's made from a grape called Bellone, not like Bologna like Oscar Mayer, but from the Italian bello, meaning beautiful. So Bellone is literally translated as big beautiful, but what's implied from that is the most beautiful. So we're about to have in your glass right now what is considered the most beautiful white wine. So have a little sniff and a swirl, and then we'll talk about this.
I just took a little bit of pita bread and put some hummus on it, and then I followed it up with a little sip of the wine.
What'd you think?
Unbelievable pairing.
We almost did. So here's where I had a little fun with you guys. For those of you that remember when we did Summer in Six Glasses, Bellone made an appearance then, but this is not that wine. This is the older sibling. This is a wine that's basically having the best year of its life ever. We'll start with the fact that every other week, if not every week, there is a wine critic that is putting this on their list of their favorite things that they drank this year. So I was super excited because after Janet picked the Heiligenstein, I was like, all right, this wine's coming no matter what. Some of the highlights, the former head of Wine Spectator, James Suckling, just gave this 98 points last week. Decanter really? Magazine in their World Wine Awards, after giving it 97 points, picked this for a platinum medal and declared it one of the best wines that they had all year round. And it made their top 100 list of the top 100 wines in the world. And Decanter drinks a ton. Guy Davini, Gambero Rosso all gave it top honors. There was one other thing that happened with this wine. At one point in time, the Italian government said, you know, if you happen to win a gold medal at the Olympics, you should drink something really good at the Italian house. The wine that was given to all the Olympians that medaled, well, that's in your glass right now also. That was kind of a fun moment for the folks at Casale di Giglio. They are one of my all-time favorite properties and one of my favorite stories. Many of you have heard me wax on poetic about them, so I'll try to give the five-minute recap. In 1907, the Santorellis opened their first olive oil and wine store in Rome. The only thing more important than God and family, and they ended up having 17 olive oil and wine stores that they opened over the next 40 years. The Santorellis were legendary for being the place to go if you needed any oil or any good drink, and they just did the best of anybody else. Then in the 1950s, old man Santorelli sold one of his stores, and everybody said, what are you going to do now, Mr. Businessman? And he told them, I bought this plot of land in Agro Pontino. And to his face, they all kind of did the bobblehead and nod, behind his back, they all went, I pazzo. He's crazy in the head. He bought a swamp. This guy is supposed to be a big businessman, and he bought a swamp. What is he thinking? But what he knew that they didn't know is that they were going to terraform the whole entire area. So they literally drained that, leaving behind the most fertile soil that had all been underwater. And then Mr. Santorelli called all of his friends from the wine industry and said, do you have a little time to come visit me in Italy? I'd like you to take a look at my lands and tell me what you would grow there. And he brought in French, Spanish, German, Northern Italian, viticulturists and enologists, and they planted the largest experimental vineyard ever in the history of all Italian winemaking in the 1960s. It started with 65 cultivars that had never before been planted in Italy. And then while they were on that project, they said, you know, there's a lot of arguments and discussions over how many grapes Italy has. Do they have 500, which everybody pretty much agrees? Yeah, they definitely have that. Do they have 1,000? It's probably a good chance of that. Do they have 2,000 or 3,000? It may be possible that it's that many too. So the Santorellis took it upon themselves to be the arbiter of sourcing all the fruit that they could and planting it in their vineyard and then trying to figure out, is this a unique cultivar or is this something that, because we were arguing one day, just to make you mad, you called it by a different name? Or as North and South, you know, the old argument that North and South don't understand each other. You look at grapes like Garganega, the grape of Suave. In Verona, it's Garganega or Garganega. In Sicily, it's Gricanico. Same grape, same exact grape, like down to the DNA. So again, with that DNA technology, this is something that the Santorellis are looking at. And so every single year they plant a few experimental grapes just to see how they turn out. And when they planted Bellone, this was an old grape that used to be part of the matrix to make Frascati. But as Frascati was thought less and less of as a serious wine and more as the thing that you just drank when you were a tourist in Rome, the golden wine of Rome became the thing that you had to have a glass of because there was no air conditioning, or you drank in front of a fountain or wherever else you were. So they were interested in mass producing the wine, not necessarily making better wines. Bologna was a key component, but because there were other more prolific grapes that provided more as far as the yield go, it just got pushed out. Right now, this grape is having its resurgence. It's one of the darling white grapes. Wine Enthusiast has published 6 articles about this grape alone this past year. Gambaroso also named it as one of the 5 Italian varietals that you should get to know if you haven't. This particular one has a little bit of oak on it. So this is, again, some of you may know my love-hate relationship with Chardonnay. This is one of those things that I offer up if you have that Chardonnay fan in your life and you're trying to get him to drink something else. I love it. I'm going to let you guys say anything you want about it so I can drink it.
Well, it's my first time tasting it, so I'm really impressed by its ease, elegance, and focus. It's what I call a wine that's made in harmony with nature. It doesn't like jump up like I need to win points. It's like, I really enjoy this, and if you swirl it and you let it finish and think about it, it's like, oh my God. It's not obvious.
It's not an obvious wine. It's subtly beautiful. So that evening that didn't end, our dear friend Rachel Lippman was unable to join us tonight because of a family commitment. And she was one of the people that was at my table. And it was her and another young lady that I adore, and her husband, and then 2 other people from the DC area. 2 of those people had dietary restrictions. So the Michelin star restaurant looked at that as, oh, that's not a problem. Everybody has to have a wonderful time. So I became one of the designated eaters at our table. As food was being passed around, I'm getting the special dietary restriction dish that's passed to me, and then the second one, and then the original dish. This was the grape that got me through that 7.5-hour dinner. Every single time, we originally started out pairing it with a specific course, but then every single time a new course would come, and I'm like, can I have a little more bologna? And when we finished the first bottle of bologna, they literally just brought over a little ice bucket and a bottle, and they're like, here, we'll just make sure it's full. And that was the thing. Everybody else is like getting up, stretching, unbuttoning, and everything else, and, you know, trying to eat a little bit more. And this was my savior. Every single time I had a little sip, it was just rich enough and just refreshing enough to make me be like, okay, I can go on. And so I am ecstatic that this wine has gotten the breadth of accolades that it has this year. And I hope you guys enjoy it. I'm going to finish my last little sip, and then we're going to move on to wine number 3 if you guys are ready for it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's for like the food side of it. It has so many options because nothing's like, it's all smooth, right? It's not like a peak of something, right? So it can all just kind of blend. So it's easier to pair with something like that. Like, you know, if you have a really acidic wine, you try to like counteract it. This, you could work with it or counteract, like contrast it.
Well, and dishes wise, if we started talking about like what's your first thing they would have that I love anything that is like the traditional Roman dishes when we're talking like a pasta alla greca or the garlic and
maybe it's not that heavy, you can do like even a crudo.
Sure. Absolutely.
It goes with Cantonese food.
There you go.
Let's change about that.
We can do that. Yeah.
But that's the thing, you know, when you start talking about what you would eat it with, sushi is fantastic with that because again, it's got the richness and it's got the brightness, but it's not, as you mentioned, the thing that's demanding your attention. It's the thing that's going to say, "What are you eating?" I'll go with that.
It's one of those ones that comes sweet underneath, and then it comes right to the peak.
You don't have enough, like if you have like a wasabi with it, like enough of that sweetness that would it would like counteract the stuff and everything. It would work really well.
I haven't found a lot of foods that it doesn't go with, but it becomes one of those bottles that I'm really interested in bringing anytime when we want to talk about food. Because I'm like, let's see.
Okay.
What won't it work with? Maybe it's not going to work with a giant bison, you know, ribeye tomahawk steak. But we should try it anyways before we say it.
I just had a little nibble of the peppercini earlier, and then I followed it up.
That pickled vinegar upset.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
It didn't cancel it out, but it complemented it. Yeah. And it was just like, it's smooth all the way through.
It's almost like the wine is saying, oh, that was a good choice to eat that. Yeah, you know, right? It's just like, you're so smart to eat that. Here, let me help you out. All right. So speaking of helping out, if it wasn't obvious before when we talked about waxing poetic on the Steiniger family, it's about to become really obvious how much we love and adore them. Because wine number three is Mr. Fotanakis' selection, which is the Steiniger Cabernet Sauvignon Rosé Sec, sparkling Cab Rosé from our friends in Austria. Many of you have known all year long and for the past 3 years how I have, without any hesitation, emphatically stated that my favorite rosé on the planet is the Steiniger Cab Rosé. They're still wine. It's magnificent. It is quite simply just near perfect wine to me. And I can't find any occasion to not drink it. I can't find any occasion to not have multiple bottles. And the only thing you could possibly do to make that wine more awesome is exactly what's about to go in your glass right now. They turned it into a sparkling wine. George, would you like to share anything about this one?
As we gave the sneak preview earlier, when we first met the group at Steiniger, literally, we were greeted with a beautiful bottle of bubbles. And she says, and I asked her if I could see the bottle. And I look at it and I go, Cabernet Sauvignon. I go, who makes rosé bubbles out of Cabernet Sauvignon? That seems a little unorthodox. I've only been in this business for about 10 years, drinking wine for many years, but not really, really taking the deep dive into it and saying, okay, well, this is interesting. How do they do this? And she went through the entire process. Then she took us through the caves and obviously, we learned about the riddling process and what they do, and the amount of the labor intensity for making sparkling wine, specifically in Austria or the old world way, is unbelievable. Because, as he mentioned, it is more of it's a hand turning process. But Cabernet Sauvignon in a glass of bubbles is unbelievable. It can be paired so many different ways. When Nick came by a couple weeks ago and he says, what are we going to do? Which one is your favorite? And I said, I think that one is, but I might want to try it again. And when I tried it again, even though I've got a whole rack of it, but we opened one up and...
Is that one any good? Let's open it.
The nose is fantastic. It's unbelievable. And what they do, they don't press the grape. They don't press the grape hard and fast. It's a delicate press. They call it bright press, where literally when they're pressing the grape, it's extracting these beautiful aromas and just the juices are coming out. And it's not more of, it lessens the harsh tannins that you might get from Cabernet Sauvignon as a whole. Because when the first thing we think about is, oh, Cab Sauv, oh, I'm having a filet tonight. You know what? We're having appetizers and we're having filet. This is unbelievable. How versatile this bottle of bubbles are. It can take you from app to main course to even dessert. It's fantastic. But when we opened it up, I go, do I smell green pepper or do I taste green peppers? And he goes, oh, you might taste that. Sometimes my palate takes me in different directions, but this thing has so many things going on with it. And I really, it's just, as you can tell, I'm very passionate about this bottle of wine.
It's a heavenly glass. It's absolutely a heavenly glass. And again, you know, part of the reason why I was excited for Gene to be on the panel tonight is that every single time we open up a bottle, if you're still not sure what you're doing for the holidays or you got a little party or something else, I figured we could tap into the chef to offer up some recommendations. But this is about as big of a meatball over the plate as you could possibly ask for when you're saying, well, what would you eat with it, Gene?
So actually, I was thinking, because I'm like, oh, what are we having? So my in-laws are German, and my in-laws stayed for like 5 days. Why still here? And we are doing for not Christmas Day, but the day after Christmas. We're doing, yeah, pork schnitzel with spätzle, gravy, rauchkraut, all that stuff. And I'm like,
yeah.
Because why not with something a little fried and rich? Yeah. Bubbles.
And like traditionally served with, you know, the schnitzels with the lemon juice, the anchovy, and the capers on top. I mean, this with just the salty.
Oh, yeah. And there's not a lot of, again, if you want to hit the major, you know, umami and food tastes, there's not a lot of rich foods that this isn't going to be a lightsaber through, just to be like, I can handle that. Salty foods, same thing. Anything fried, oh my God. It's so, yep.
Soft, yeah. Soft cheese, feta cheese, soft cheese.
Almost any cheese. It doesn't matter the milk source.
Yeah.
I mean, we could even go after.
I'm Greek, so I'm going to go straight to
it. Vegan cashew cheeses and everything else, I wouldn't even have a problem putting this up against that. That would be a happy thing.
Yeah.
But also, for me, my favorite pairing that I found with this wine, this is the ultimate compliment for anything Cajun or Creole. When you're talking about building all those flavors, like with the Mother Roux, you know, it is one of those things. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, think about that when you have, you know, blackened food, you have that intensity of that. When you have the Cajun food and you make that really dark roux and you have that richness, this is one of those things that is welcoming. Yeah, go ahead, throw in andouille, throw in gator, throw in shrimp, fish, whatever you want.
Andouille.
Oh my goodness, absolutely. So I don't know if you guys just heard that recommendation, but this is one that everybody should file in the back of your head. Janet just called out one of the most perfect, simple little breakfasts, and as long as the holidays and we're having bubbles, it doesn't count as drinking at breakfast, a Smithfield ham biscuit with this. There you go.
Easy.
Good call. Great call. And again, this is, as George pointed out, it's Cabernet Sauvignon. So for all those people that normally say, oh, I don't drink pink wine, no. This is diffusing any and all arguments because it's Cabernet Sauvignon. So if you don't drink Cab, and I will give you a pass to not drink this because that means there's more wine for us.
Yeah.
But everybody who is afraid of pink wine or says pink wine is not for serious drinking or anything else, here is your trump card. Any questions?
Why are you doing Gene's recipe with pork schnitzel?
Okay, so this from a master chef. He was German, old guy, and he's like, show me how to do it. So you take clarified butter, okay, and you take your pork, you pound it out. I use a pork loin. I slice it, pound it out. I bread it. So I do flour, egg wash, breadcrumb. I do panko. It's too thick. Actual bread, like the actual breadcrumb. Don't get the seasoned stuff. Season it yourself. And then when you bread it, make sure you press real good in there, right? And then I fried it in the clarified butter. And then when I serve it with traditionally the lemon slice, capers, and the anchovy.
So for your breadcrumb seasoning, salt, pepper? Salt, pepper, anything else?
Yeah, salt, pepper, and that's it. The clarified butter adds a ton of flavor, and the salt from the anchovy, you don't want to get too crazy with it. Then we serve with spätzle, gravy, and rauchkraut stuff.
Yum, yum.
Thank you.
Yep, the clarified butter makes a huge difference. It's not cheap to clarify that much butter, but
so we'll work on getting the recipe in detail, and I'll tell you what, if you email me at some point in time, I'll make sure that I stay on Gene, and we'll get that recipe emailed out to all of you.
Okay, so I'd like to give a tip here.
Sure.
So ghee is the same thing as clarified butter. You can get a treat.
It's a differently styled version of clarified butter that just has a little more richness, and again, as Gene stated, this combination that's somewhere between a darkness and caramel, I guess, would be the way that you would describe it a little
bit.
Yeah,
it's more nutty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they let actually, technically, when I do mine, it is more ghee because I don't sip on.
The truth comes out.
Yeah. It's so easy to just put butter in a pot and just let it boil away. And so butter is made up of three things, right? The milk proteins, the water, and the fat. You're taking away the water and you're taking away the milk proteins, gives you the fat, has a higher smoke point, so you're going to fry with it. So you put a pat of butter in the fry pan, like everything starts smoking and stuff, burning, right? So the smoke point is when you raise the oil's temperature, like smoke point is when it breaks down, right? It starts like denaturing and tasting weird. So if you raise the fat smoke point, then you can do different stuff with it. So that's why people clarify butter or do ghee. Technically, I do more of a ghee style because I'm too lazy to collect, like scrape off the top. I just let it boil, and when it foams, I turn it off, let it settle. All the foam goes to all the milk proteins go to the bottom. They do toast a little bit, and I just pour it off.
More time for you to drink.
Yeah, and if you drink too much and you forget about it, it still kind of holds its own because you just turn it off and you don't have to worry about it.
All right.
Yeah.
Speaking of, we're working on it. Only good stuff. Speaking of good stuff, we are on to our first red if nobody has any more questions. So if you'd like to pour number four into your glass. Number four is a selection from our good friend Gene Lampione. Gene, would you like to reveal to everybody what this wine is, or should I do the honors? Why don't we do that? Everybody, take a smell of your wine and then take a big old sip.
We've had this on a panel before.
We have. So, all right, we'll hold back on revealing for a moment.
This was my.
I'm hearing a couple people mention that they're getting a very fruity nose. I heard cherry pie over here. Anybody else want to offer up anything that they're getting on the nose or the taste of the wine? I heard sweet, fruity. I'm going to say absolutely 100%. It's definitely a fruity wine. This is this is the youngest wine most of you probably have drunk unless you engaged in the time-honored tradition of Beaujolais Nouveau, which this is a riff on that. In your glass right now is the 2024 Low Vineyards Nouveau wine from Mount Airy, Maryland. Go local.
So the reason I wanted to pick this one, I tried so hard to like Beaujolais Nouveau wines. I can't do it. I don't know why. And Nick had me on a panel in the back.
Summer.
And this was on the wine. I was like, oh, man, all right, fine. Maryland, all right.
I'm only here for the free drinks, not to sit.
And I was like, crap. You know, I was like, yeah, first dip, let me give it another one. I was like, holy crap, right? And like, whoa. And it just surprised me so much. And actually, like, I didn't really enjoy it. I'm just surprised, but it was a really fun experience for me.
Slight chill neck.
Barbera.
You could put a slight
chill. So what you guys are drinking is 100% Barbera,
delicious.
Grown up outside of Roarsville, Maryland, by our good friend Dave Collins, the winemaker at Big Cork, and he sells his Barbera to Rachel. And he's promised Rachel as much of the Barbera as she wants so that she can make this wine, because he was blown away by it, just like Gene was all the years that she did that. I admit I'm like Gene. You know, 2024 is the first year that I have absolutely enjoyed drinking Beaujolais Nouveau in probably at least a decade, maybe even longer. It's the first actual good harvest that France has had. So we've been suffering under having these wines that are very rooted in tradition, but very much also one of those things that makes me feel like somebody is just stealing my wallet. There's no reason for me to drink these. There's no joy. And that's what Beaujolais is supposed to be all about. Nouveau is supposed to be the first wine of the season. The first harvest, so it's just a celebration that we're finally done. The year is over. Now it's time to make wine and for everything to rest. And this is what's just going to carry you over for a little bit. All right, so multiple things happened. In France, what happened is exactly what you said, climate. It was the first good vintage. France has been, for the last 12 years, unfortunately, the most ridiculous, bad possible weather scenarios that you can imagine have been going on in France. They've only had since 2005, I'm going to say like three vintages that were of significance. And the rest, especially when it comes to this area with Beaujolais Nouveau, they had rains, they had frost, they had late rains, they had hail. They couldn't catch a break. It was just one of those things that the wine gods didn't want them making wine, but you had to make something. In our case of this one in Maryland, you know, we look at 2024 as a year. 2024 was starting out to be potentially the best year ever for Maryland wines. Coming on the heels of 2023, which literally was the best harvest they've ever had, the best growing season. And then we got to this point, if you remember, that we just started getting really warm all summer long. All summer, heat and more heat and more heat and no rain. Heat and heat, no rain and no rain and no rain. And so it was shaping up to be one of those years where, even though it's hot for our area and the Atlantic coast, we're getting full ripeness though because of all this heat. And then as they start to harvest, we got our butts handed to us by Mother Nature, and she rained tremendously. And if you rain while you're trying to harvest, what happens is you're waiting as the viticulturist, as the winemakers, as the enologist, you're waiting to harvest your grapes when they get to the ripeness. And so whether you're old school going out and tasting the grapes and just saying, nope, it's not there yet, or you're using a refractometer and getting the bricks and the sugar level where you want, what you're waiting for is when that sugar peaks, and then you're like, great, let's go get everything. And it happened that we started harvest in Maryland, and then the rain started. And that's like if you're making soup or making stock or making a sauce, and you get it exactly where you want it to go, and then somebody comes along and pours a gallon of water into all that hard work that you just did. So imagine that from a cooking perspective, where everything is fine, and now all of a sudden everything is diluted. And so what you had is this race against time. We got some grapes in before the rain, and then the rain didn't stop. It was terrible, torrential rains. We had damage in the vineyards. You had so much rain, and everything else was one of those situations where you're looking at your fruit that was great. And now, especially in the case of a lot of the vintners that are around here, you had contracted to buy this fruit, and now they're going to pull it in, but it's nowhere near the fruit you wanted when you were hoping to get it. And so it's this super duper juggling act of trying to see, all right, what do we do now? Can we wait it out? Are we going to get continuous rains? Because sometimes that's what happens once the rain's starting hitting around Maryland. It's just going to rain all the time, and there's no good time to harvest when it's raining. Or do we get a couple of days where it dries out and it heats up? Fortunately for Rachel, you know, Barbera is this great grape that is very adaptable, and it is one of those grapes that is not as susceptible to powdery mildew and the wet conditions and everything else. So she was able to make something that, again, when you're going around and I'm talking about it, has that super upfront freshness to it, has that great fruity bite to it. But being Barbera, as opposed to Beaujolais, when you're dealing with that with France, there is a little different acidity structure to it. And there is simultaneously the potential to make bigger and better wines out of Barbera than you can out of Beaujolais, unless you're in a cru area, in the best of best areas. So yeah. This is something that, you know, with Gamay, you know, you're going to get a light and fruity wine with great perfuminess, but not a lot of structure and depth. Gives you that structure, gives you that depth, gives you that acidity. I look at this wine and I was so excited. Gene actually looked at me, would that be weird if I picked one of Rachel's wines because she's on the panel all the time? I'm like, absolutely not. We're here to pick something delicious. And this is a wine that made an impression on me. I drank the 2023 all year long. And normally with Nouveaux, you want to drink them by Easter. You know, it's released in November and you want to finish it up by the time March rolls around so you can drink the actual wines that you should be drinking. This is one of those wines that ages tremendously well. It drinks with that same freshness all year round. She actually even made this into a sparkling wine this year called Haya. And it's absolutely wonderful. And she's contemplating doing basically a Maryland Lambrusco at some point in time. I love it. I could look at this wine all day long. I could smell this wine all day long. And it's one of those things that I encourage everybody to drink this like you would beer. I mean, literally, you want to go have hot dogs and a bottle of wine, this is it. Sausage, chicken wings, sitting around snacking on food or chocolate chip cookies in this. It's one of those wines that just works in so many different ways. And I'm super proud to say that, A, it's my friend. B, it's our panelist. C, it's a Maryland wine. I mean, you can just go on and on and on. This is just really fun.
But I tried them simultaneously.
You know, I was taken.
But then all I remembered was the time, and I remember the wine. I don't remember, you know, which one specifically.
Yes.
When you talk about the rains affecting the grapes, how quickly does that happen? I mean, if they're going out to harvest on Monday and it's raining on Monday, for the grapes,
they stop harvesting. Most of the time they're not. I mean, it depends on how heavy the rain is. Because again, it's one of those things. If it's a light little missing thing, that's not going to really affect you. If it's thunderstorms and downpouring, you know, heavy rain, that's the type of stuff that is going to damage the bunches. It's going to damage the grapes, and immediately, you know, think about how long. When we have a serious rain, how long that rain puddles up in your yard or on the streets or everything else. You're in the vineyards, you know, if it's very dry, it's one of those things that they welcome the rain, that first rain, because it's going to soak into the ground really quick. But when it rains for 3 or 4 days in a row, that's when you're stepping down to like 2 inches of muck and water and everything else. And that's where it rained, I want to say, for almost like 7 to 10 days where it just rained. Yes. The vines, the grape clusters. So you, in an ideal world, as a winemaker, you want your grapes to struggle. It's like when they tell you with your plants, you know, give them three to six ounces of water every 3 days or so. You know, so it's just enough to give them this little trickle that fortifies them, but also they have to decide. The plant needs to know, am I going to put my energy into, in the case of grapes, am I going to put my energy into the grapes? Am I going to put my energy into the leaves? Or am I going to put my energy into the vine? And so when the water soaks in that much, when most of the energy is going into those grapes, suddenly it's overpowering the whole entire plant. And it's a little bit of this, like, I don't know what to do, so I'm going to disperse everything everywhere. So at that point in time, if all the energy is now spread out, it's not going in to make those grape clusters as good as they could be. But you're also getting that water that's in there that is going to inflate the grapes instead of being concentrated. You're watering down all the flavor, all the taste, the alcohol, the sugar levels, and all that you have. Yeah. So again, when we're talking about wines, we're really looking to every point and a half of Brix is about a point of alcohol. So you're looking for this minimum of like 24, 27 Brix before you even want to start harvesting. So if you're ready to harvest and you're at that point and then suddenly it rains, then it drops. So you're at that point where you're going to get more bitterness and weak and soft flavors, and you're not going to have any character. You're going to get a loose, thin little wine, which is pretty much, if you want to talk about when we drink bad local wines, is what happens. You're not harvesting good grapes. You're just harvesting grapes to make something. You're not actually harvesting the thing that you want to make. Does that make a little sense? Yeah. Well, as long as we're on low vineyards, sure, is Nouveau.
Okay, so this is the Barbera. Fit into the name.
So Barbera fits into this only in so much as that's the vehicle that Rachel has chosen. So if Rachel were here, she would tell you she hates Nouveau. She loves the idea of Nouveau. She loves the concept of it. She loves the story of telling how the French used to fight each other in the streets and there were robbers and everything else trying to steal your wine on the way to market because that was the thing that everybody was doing. It was the first to market, made the most money, and all that history is great. She studied abroad in France, so she was really, you know, this was impressed upon her significantly, the importance of Nouveau. Regardless of how it tastes and how you think of the wine, the importance of it is that this is the celebration as a winemaking country, as a winemaking area, that Nouveau is what celebrates that you've done a great job, you've made it to the harvest, you're making your first wine, and this is your first preview, your movie teaser trailer of what's to come from everything else that you do. So the idea behind Nouveau is just that. It's young, it's fresh, drink it. And usually, I had a friend in the Army, Wendy Latimer. She was one of the greatest people that affected my wine life. She worked for a wine company out in Arizona, and she took me under her wing and would put up with me asking 6 billion questions and wanting to drink everything I could get my hands on. And she taught me about Nouveau. The way you figure out if Beaujolais Nouveau is any good, find another friend that likes to drink Beaujolais Nouveau, sip them down on a stoop, pour half in their glass, half in your glass, pound it down. If you can get up and you don't feel anything, it's just okay. Go find another bottle. So the idea behind Nouveau is just that. This is a wine for celebrating everything else. For Rachel, her intent was to say, it's not enough for me to just make something that is just okay. And working for our company, for CMO Wines, for a long period of time, she got to go over to Italy several times and got to experience a lot of the wonderful grapes from Italy. And one of the grapes that she adored was Barbera because of its giant flexibility. As far as trying to pin Barbera in the corner, you can't. There's a reason it's the most widely planted grape in all of Piedmont is because you can mold that into whatever you feel like doing. And at the same time, even if you don't want to make a heavy Barbera wine, Barbera is like spackle. It brings fruit, it brings structure, it brings color into whatever you're doing. So if your wine is a little thin, have some Barbera. You might have made, we at one point in time, were you with us at the time when we did the 9 Barbera tasting at the office? Or was that? So at one point in time, my company imported 13 different Barberas into the United States. And so we one day sat down and we literally drank every single Barbera just so we could make a definitive guide of why do we have 13? And that seems a little excessive, but then when we started going through it, you know, we're having one from Monferrato, one from La Mora, one from the Lange, and we're having all these different expressions of it. Some that are unoaked, some that are rosé, some that are sparkling, some that have use of new oak, large oak barriques, small barriques. We're looking at every single different version of it that you can have. And what you find is Barbera is super fun. Barbera is like your best party friend ever that you can say, I want to stay home and watch movies. I want to dress up to the nines and go out. I want to take a road trip to Fiji. It's that thing that it doesn't matter. It's down for whatever you want to do. And And that's what's so fun about it. And that's why Rachel picked this grape, because she said, look, I want to make an expression of Nouveau, but I don't want it to suck. And Barbera from Dave Collins has this great spiciness and great richness. So she saw that as, by starting with a higher quality grape, I can make something that is really fun. But also, as I said, this is a Barbera Nouveau that is going to last you well into a year. I have two bottles left of last year's vintage. They're throwing tons of sediment and everything else at the top, but God, they're glorious, and it's so much fun. The thing you have to get by is talking to everybody. We're like, look, you've got to buy an inch of gunk on your cork, but just ignore that. Drink through it. It'll be fine. So does that help a little bit? All right. Well, I'm going to have to wax a little more poetic about Barbera, because unfortunately, Rachel got called away. But I still ask Rachel, you know, you need to give us something because you've been so integral to the podcast. So what is your pick for what's your favorite wine? And she said, you know, I got to tell you, my favorite wine number 5, which you should pour in your glasses right now, is Rachel's brand new Cabernet Franc. So I know many of you are familiar with Lowe Vineyards. For those of you that are not, I'm going to try to do justice to one of the most amazing stories that I could ever possibly share with you. Lowe is a family vineyard in Mount Airy, Maryland, that was founded by Rachel's grandfather. He was a Holocaust survivor. He came over, his family, many of you, if any of you are Montgomery County educators, have probably run across the Lippmann family at some point in time. They were stalwarts, both in the community and in the wine industry, and they were, you know, really, really driven by her grandfather. And he controlled everything. As much as the family right now, it's a bunch of female bosses. I'm sorry, but they are all badass and unbelievable. And they take no prisoners. They know what they want. And they go out there and they accomplish it. And this is a family, though, that when it came to wine, it was all about him, Wolfgang. He was the one. He was in charge of everything else, except for when his granddaughter took an inkling towards wine. And then she went to University of Maryland, and then she went to France and studied abroad. And she came back and she kept helping grandpa with the wine. And there was something special about her, and he could tell she was talented. She went to work at a local little wine shop before she was legally supposed to be drinking. And that's where I first met her. And I, again, as we've talked about the statute of limitations, I can no longer get in trouble for when the boss went in the back room. I mean, Rachel, you need to try this. And here's what this is. And we would drink all these wines, and it was clear to me that this was a person that, however long she's in our atmosphere, we benefit from. She is a great palate. She identifies so much stuff. And as an 18-year-old, she knew more about wine than most of the people that were walking into the wine store looking for wine to buy. And so it was really fun when she came to work for me, because then it was this chance where, you know, I could build on everything that she learns. And that's why she's, you guys are great. I love you all. You're fantastic. It's why she's one of my favorite people on the panel, because I've known her basically her entire drinking life. So nowadays, as a winemaker, it's great because we can see where we affected her when she was working with. That's the whole reason why the Barbera Nouveau came about, because she knew Barbera from working with Siema Wines and going over and visit the Italians. In fact, there's some Italians that have asked her to come consult and maybe help me out with my wines over there, which I'm like, how cool is that? But she remains committed to her family winery and making sure that the family winery comes first before anything else. And that grape that really is the thing that Maryland is probably going to be known for anything else is Cabernet Franc. She's very good on social media. And if you need, there's, all right, I'm going to say this at my own risk. I think there's like 9 tickets left to her January blending seminar, where you want to get an inside look on what's going on in the Maryland wine industry, how do you make a great wine, and then hearing all about the Lowe story. January 25th at Lowe Vineyards, they're doing a blending seminar. And I apologize if it's all sold out. Like I said, I think there was only 9 tickets left earlier today. But again, Wolfgang was running the wine operation. Rachel got her degree and became, you know, that this little push on everything that he was doing. He wanted to do all the traditional things. She'd say, but wouldn't it be cool if we did this? Wouldn't it be cool if we did this? Wouldn't it be cool if we did this? When he passed away several years ago, Rachel was just in her second year of taking over the reins of making the wines. He was the only one she trusted to make the wines, and the only one that he really believed was going to carry on his legacy. And he also knew she had every single talent she needed to continue to make these wines better and better. And so now Rachel, like many of the other winemakers we talked to, you know, she feels she's communicating with her or their ancestors and everybody that came before her when she makes her wines. So she puts that type of love and dedication to everything. This is a single clone of Cabernet Franc that she's using to make this. that she finds is incredibly aromatic. It's got little bits of mint and fruit that are all throughout it. She submitted this to TechSom, and it was recognized as one of the best Cabernet Francs in the United States. We are drinking perhaps one of the most incredible stories that you will hear, both from a female winemaker, from the Holocaust survivor, and also from the fact that when people try this, nobody thinks that's got to be a Maryland wine. That's as far as from anybody could say. You guys want to talk so I can drink? About one third of this is in oak. Everything is 2 and 3 years old oak. Nothing's new. I can't remember if she does a little bit that of 4 year oak, but a majority is 2 and 3 year old oak and stainless steel. She is doing again just a long extended cold soak, a controlled soak on this wine, so that it's soaking in all those flavors and developing this richness. For me, Cab Franc is always looked at, except in France, as a little bit lesser to American Cabernet Sauvignon, because it's again, it's a blending grape, it's a building block grape, it's something that doesn't stand on its own. And here, when you see this as 100% Cab Franc with no blending, yeah, I think it's glorious.
But this is pretty interesting.
Right?
So I'd like to say something that is really consistent about this tasting for me, is that when you don't know what a wine is, you look at the back of the label and you look at who the importer is. And if you agree with that taste, everything's consistent. So what I would like to say is the wine selections are consistent. And what it is, they're in harmony with nature. They really have a really entry level of elegance and refinement. And then if you stay with it, it kind of like really piques you at the back of it. They're mysterious. They're not obvious. And they're great with food, so you can lay into that one.
Yeah, I always told when I was teaching in Italy, I taught in Florence for 3 years, International Culinary School. I got to work with the Italian Sommelier Association to make the class and everything. My class was food and wine pairing. The students would come in, I'd teach them how to make an Italian dish. And then once we made it, then we'd have a couple bottles of wine and said, this goes with it, this doesn't go with it, and why.
It's a really tough job.
I know, it was hard. But I always told my students, like she was saying, it's all
moods.
Like, you don't want a roller coaster wine, right? You don't want spikes and, you know, like acid.
You know what's great in Nola wine tastes when your phone just starts talking for no reason whatsoever?
Because you either contrast or compliment. So, like, if you get like a little bit of like sweetness, then you can even do something spicy and it kind of amplifies the spice and the acidity goes down a little bit. And then it, like we were talking earlier, I forget which wine, but we were talking about with the wasabi.
Yeah.
I think in the
really rare one, the white one.
Yeah. The two. Yeah. Yeah. Number two. Like we were saying, like the wasabi would bring out a little bit of that sweetness of the wine. There's not much sweetness there, but it would contrast each other and it would make it pop a little bit, which is fun because then like the acidity would be a little bit less, and they would counteract the fattiness of the, you know, the raw fish or whatever you have with sushi. So there's things like when I try to have a wine, like everybody asks me, like, how do you pair and stuff like that? Always try to go with something that's balanced and smooth. No like spike or roller coaster like bunk. Because it's a lot easier to like contrast or complement something. And if you have the spikes, then it's like, oh, then I have to go like extreme with the food. Right. If I have the waves, like smoothness, then it's easier to, you know, I don't have to spike the food and the flavor. Like, I don't have to put us on the acidity to it. I don't have to put on the sweetness.
All the wines here can either support the food or really ride the top of it. And the last one, for me, kind of had like a cinnamon aspect to it. And so I was thinking, this would be great with turkey. Great with Thanksgiving for people who serve this, you know, at Christmas, that would be good as well.
Mm-hmm.
And also duck.
Yeah, so the last one I think, because we're doing a duck dish for my Christmas.
Exactly. And so, you know, just have a good time. You know, we're just geeking here, but just have a good time and experiment, experience for yourself.
Yeah, so I was thinking the last one, going through my menu in my head where we're doing so many days of all this food that we're making, which I love to cook, and my wife is also a chef. We met at culinary school and all that fun stuff. And so one of our dishes we're doing a parsnip puree with seared duck breast with cranberry sauce and a crunchy bread on top, like croutons almost. And I mean, that would put a little cinnamon thing in the cranberry, and it would just and then a little bit of the fatness of the duck.
So any other thoughts, any other questions? Because we're at that combination horrible, wonderful, awful time when we hit the last wine, but I've saved my selection. Not that the other ones, you know, I didn't have any influence on.
This didn't take long for him to explain.
No, not at all.
I mean, of all the people that are going to ask me, you have some explaining to do with this wine. I would expect nothing less from George. Our final wine of the evening is Maison Caralcadere La Folie, the Fools. It is a gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous French Bordeaux blend, 85% Merlot, 15% Cab Franc, from a family that originally started, sorry, George, in Turkey. But they expanded and they met up with Stefan Derenkor, one of the foremost winemakers and consulting wine guys that is on the planet next to Michele Roland. He's probably equally famous. And they bought three small estates in Bordeaux to start making these gorgeous, gorgeous wines. And then they had a consultant come in from Italy who happens to be the father of the winemaker Francesco from Manchiero Carbone in Canale in Piedmont. And Lucrezia, Francesco's wife, was in town. And I happened to have these wines in my bag. And she goes, oh, you've got my father-in-law's wine. And I'm like, no, that's Turkish. What are you talking about? She goes, no, he consults with them. And I'm like, no, they're Turkish. Wait, what? Completely unbeknownst to me and unbeknownst to anybody else involved, Siema had both, you know, the wines from Manchiero Carbone and Canale, one of my favorite stories for Italian wines. And then these great Turkish wines that we had started because we had lost some of our Turkish imports. And suddenly here it is where it's meant to be. And I think, you know, we've had some interesting years, as I mentioned, with French wines having some bad vintages and unlucky with the weather. And so for me, the combination of knowing it's a Turkish family that are the owners that bought property in France, that have an amazing consulting winemaker, that have an Italian consulting winemaker also. It just was too much for me to say, all right, I definitely have to try this wine. And it blew me away. It absolutely blew me away because this is one of those wines that I think stops traffic. It stops everything that you're doing and you want to sit down and smell it and drink it and drink more of it and then drink more of it. And it's just, again, it's really pretty. At my heart, I love Pinot Noir more than any other grape, because it's so aromatic. And for me, with my big Roman nose, I get a ton of aromatics whenever I'm drinking wine. But there's something about this that, you know, that combination of Cab Franc and Merlot, it works so well together. And I didn't know that Rachel was going to pick Cab Franc. And it was one of those things that I thought to myself, you know, are we overloading everybody with Cab Franc? But then what it came down to was, no, this is about what's the best stuff that we've had all year long? And what's something that I can throw in front of you that maybe it's a little unfortunate. I know you guys come to all my wine tastings all the time, but no matter how many you come to, we're still probably going to have drunk more than you have this year. So what's the thing that we can throw out there that's just different enough and out of left field and really just it hits on all notes, right?
Yeah, I've never had that in a wine.
It's so many different spices.
It's really beautiful.
And you've got that great red fruit leaning towards dark, and it keeps vacillating. I want to be cherry, but nah, I can be more serious than that. Right? Evan. So for those of you that missed that, you know, the comment from Janet was, oh my God, is that really the price?
Yeah, it punches higher.
Well, look, I've long espoused, I love drinking wine, but it's a lot more fun to be able to drink it than to just sit it, looking it on your shelf or in the shelf of a wine shop and say, I'm never going to buy that. This has all the hallmarks for me. Again, why I tasted this wine first probably in February or March was when I first had it. And it stuck with me all year long. All year long, this was one of those wines that I kept thinking about because I can't, again, with most of the stuff, I'm going to think about what's the best food, what's the best wine, what's the occasion, everything else. And there are a few wines like the Anthium, like the Steinigers, that I don't care what the occasion is. It's the wine is going to rise to that to match up. And so as long as we're not talking having, you know, tea or, you know, something that's really like a lemon meringue pie, this wine is going to be there for you. As far as age worthiness, so most of these vines are about 20 to 35 years old, but they have enough on them at that point in time that you're going to be looking at 5 to 12 years on this wine where it's going to continue to reward you. It's not, it's just barely, if you turn your glass to the side, if you have any wine left, It's just barely showing a different hue of violet on the rim of the wine. Really, really pale and probably not really defined. It's got a lot of power to it. So again, I have no worries thinking about this wine in 5 years from now about how great it's going to be. But it's delicious now, and that's the other wonderful thing. So even though this is a young vine wine project, it's showing all that promise of youth and all that vigor that it has. And so to me, it's just absolutely delightful. And I got to tell you, really shocking that of all the 600 Italian wines, 100 Spanish wines, that you know my favorite wine would end up being a French wine.
Yeah.
This year. Who knew? Surprise. What do you guys think? Any thoughts, any questions, any favorites of anything we had tonight? Well, ladies and gentlemen, again, if nobody has any questions, I need to, first of all, thank our panel because these guys helped me get it off the ground. Obviously, I love drinking in a social capacity, but when I can forget that I'm working and just drink and geek out, as everybody has showed you we are wont to do tonight, this is what makes it all promising for me. This is the thing that I love more than everything else because we can connect over these drinks and we can talk about planning the next meal, the next dinner, or what this would go good. And when we walk away, we have all these other thoughts, you know, that we had our own personal like direction that we were heading in, but now suddenly our world has grown and we've got a lot more thoughts of what we want to eat and what we want to drink. And so that was always my hope in starting the tasting panel was to get people that, you know, as much as I enjoy them, maybe you guys don't know them as well. So I want you to get to know them all. So we hope to continue this in the new year. We are going to do another event with Vasilis January 29th. We haven't figured out the theme yet and everything else. We haven't talked about who's available, but we have picked the date. So we are going to continue this in the new year. We are also, for those of you in the Potomac region, going to go visit another favorite palate of mine. We're going to take this on the road, and we are going to go to Wayland's Beer and Wine in Potomac and visit our good friend Tim Clune, who has held just about every single job in the wine industry. And right now he's working on being the guy that makes everything into pickles, and he's being a pickle somm. But we are gonna go visit Wayland's on January 14th, and we're gonna do a variation of our little wine tasting there. And then in February, on February 6th, we'll be at finewine.com, and we're gonna take the podcast over there also. And then also coming soon, Zinnia in Silver Spring on Colesville Road. We're going to take over their wine room, and we're going to also do another one of these there. So from the bottom of my heart, I thank you guys for coming out, because if you guys don't come out, we don't get to drink and do all these fun things. So thank you so much. Those of you that are interested in playing the home game, once again, George has graciously offered to take orders for anybody. So if you want to fill out that last sheet that I just passed out to you all, put that together, hand it back to us, and we'll make sure you get all the wine you want. Those of you waiting on some of the wine from the last event, the Malbec 6, I believe Rachel just today delivered the last of the cases of Malbec, hopefully.
Yes.
Cross my fingers.
Maybe.
So those wines should be ready for pickup shortly. Come and find us after the tasting, and we'll talk about that if you're still waiting on a wine. And in the meanwhile, again, a big hand for all of you. Thank you so much for coming out for this. Have a great holiday season. Have a wonderful New Year. Have a happy Krampus, Festivus, and whatever holiday you would like to celebrate. I look forward to drinking with you all in 2025. Thanks for making this possible. Cheers for many more.
Yeah.